We're about to talk to Mary Helen Washington, who's a professor of English at the University of Maryland College Park. She's written this amazing book called The Other Blacklist, The African-American Literary and Cultural Left of the 1950s. She's been a Bunting Fellow at Harvard University and taught the University of Massachusetts, editor of Black-Eyed Susans, classic stories by black women writers, Midnight Birds, stories of contemporary black women writers, Invented Lives, the narratives of black women and memory of kin, stories of family by black writers. An amazing body of work.
Thank you.
We can see your focus.
Yes.
Yes. But then came this.
Yeah, it looks like the focus changed from the intense look at black women writers to writers on the left. But I think that there's definitely a continuum there, that those writers that I talked about and wrote about in the 1970s and 1980s, black women writers were also radicals in the sense of they were pursuing work on black women, with black women characters and a focus on black women's lives. And that was radical for the 1970s.
Right.
So you can see that the direction of my life has always been to move towards who seems to be on the margins, who seems to have been minimalized, especially in African American literature, since that's my subject.
So, I mean, but this particular subject, I think that is interesting. There's been this huge controversy I've noticed over the last 15, 20 years, maybe more recently, of black writers and their influence in and influence by the communist movement of the 30s, 40s, and 50s, especially in America, and those who say, no, it was just the opposite, and use, you know, examples of writers who left the Communist Party and put it down, didn't maybe be a part of it, and there's somebody who's writing a book now about the writers who turned their back on the left in America who are black. So this seems to be this, and then I saw your book come through, because I think that there's such a history here. As you write in the beginning of your book, people know about the Hollywood 10, if they know about it at all, and they know about the people who are blacklisted, about the House on American Activities Committee going after white activists, but the other blacklist is invisible.
Right. The other blacklist, in contrast to the pattern that you're talking about, where we focus on the writers who turned away from the Communist Party, say Ralph Ellison or Richard Wright, maybe even James Baldwin, that has always been the standard practice in African-American literary history, in American literary history, is to focus on them. And there's all kinds of reasons for that, mainly the demonization of the Communist Party. So it was really exciting and kind of a revolutionary thought that all of these writers actually not only influenced by the party and the left, but were either in the party or the left or close to it. And so I wanted to look at the 1950s because the 1950s was a time when it was dangerous to be associated with the left. And
right.
I wanted to look at the writers and the artists who stayed close to the left all the way during that decade. And, you know, what I found is, and of course, I'm not the only one doing this. I mean, if you look at Bill Maxwell, James Smethurst, Alan Wall, Barbara Foley, I mean, now we have a kind of cottage industry of people looking at what happened in the 40s and 50s with black artists and intellectuals and writers on the left. But suddenly, you know, you found all of these places that they were involved in, organizations that they were involved in. And, of course, you find lots of connections with people that you thought, well, I had no idea that they had anything to do with the left. Sidney Poitier, Ruby Dee, Ossie Davis.
Right,
I mean, all of these people were on the left. And I'm saying the left deliberately. I'm not trying to put them in the Communist Party. On the left. So many people that we had no idea of how widespread this was and how deeply informed people were about left and radical politics. So the excitement about this is how undiscovered it was. And I don't think that's an accident at all. I mean, look at all of the writers in this book and the artists in this book. They all have an FBI file, with one exception. That's Gwendolyn Brooks. And that FBI file is the sign of what was happening in the 1950s and why they had to hide and, you know, play down their associations. And, of course, by playing down those associations, they played right into the hands of the people who wanted to say, oh, no, these good people had nothing to do with the left.
There's an interesting passage I'll get to, and there's about a particular woman artist who that happened to, and they say, no, she was very involved in Mexico and here, and
yes,
and they tried to whitewash that, but it didn't happen.
Yes.
I mean, but we shouldn't let that happen. But I think there was you talk about this, it was a natural, in many ways, it was a natural fit because of the hyper-racist nature of society in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, the segregation and the communist being, as you write, the only real political party in America came out to say we're fighting against white supremacy and this injustice, and it has to end. That was part of the attraction.
And, you know, to take it one step further, the attraction was that on the left you had the most sophisticated and important theorization of race. And so when they used the term white supremacy, they were talking about a system, they were talking about a structure, and that was at a moment in which the way race was being talked about was dampening down any kind of radical understanding of race. And so we came through the 1950s with the idea that, and this was very much promoted by the State Department, this was very much promoted by any kind of anti-communist effort, that racism was a fast disappearing aberration. That's right out of the State Department pamphlet. And it, what also was being promoted was this idea of race progress. Okay, if you just look at people like Marian Anderson, you will see, and Jackie Robinson, you will see that there's a racial progress narrative. And that narrative was becoming the standard way we understood race. And you see in the introduction to my book, I start off with the idea of this is the decade that I'm informed by. This is the decade that made me, the 1950s. So I understood very clearly how much that particular race progress narrative was being pushed and promulgated and how dangerous it was because what it said, and, you know, I think even the Brown versus the Board of Education decision says this too. It says if only black people would make themselves acceptable, they'd be ready for integration. That's the way our understanding of race had moved by the 1950s. Now, you look back at the writers and artists and political activists of who came out of the left, they were using terms like white supremacy.
Right.
And understanding that race, for example, was not just a national problem, that it was connected to colonialism, connected to, I mean, Paul Robeson's paper Freedom, which was one of the most radical papers in the 1950s, always connected racism in the United States with apartheid in South Africa. Now, you could only get that kind of message in a left-wing publication.
Right. It was beyond the notion of integration, as you write about. It was beyond the notion of integration. So you talk about a number of incredible moments in kind of the intellectual artistic forces in the black community that we don't really think about very much. I mean, and you spend a lot of time in the beginning of the book, but then a whole chapter on Charles White.
Yes. He's the one visual artist in the book. All the rest are artists of the
written Paul Robeson of the canvas or something that you, right?
Yes, Paul Robeson with the brush.
With the brush.
Mm-hmm. And again, here is an artist who's also an intellectual and an activist. But if you look at his art and say, how is it that here in the late 1940s and the 1950s, you have this artist who's producing these wonderful portraits of black people with dignity and heroism and power, countering all of those stereotypes and of black people that had been, you know, part of the national fabric. Now, I'm not saying that that's only because he was on the left, but the left was where he got support for his work. And it is problematic for us not to connect him with the left and with the radicalism and to understand that the left gave him a platform for being able to paint the way he wanted to and to paint these wonderful, heroic, and beautiful portraits of black people. That came because he had the support, the institutional support. And when I say institutional support, I mean places like the ACA Gallery that showed artist on the left, or his biographer who was from East Germany, who did the first artistic biography of Charles White. I mean, this was a time when, in fact, his first biographer, Peter Clothier, said when he came across Charles White, he met him in California, he said, I had no idea that there was this kind of work being done by black artists, because it was not part of the national artistic community to even do shows with black artists.
I mean, you have these great stories about him in Chicago and the WPA and the kind of, and how he decided through all this kind of give his art and service to the struggle, to, that this is part of what he became. He became a, I mean, he's really not known by many today.
Well, he's known in the black community.
No, I'm saying, but you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. In the larger world, and even outside the black artistic intellectual world, he's not known. He's an artist, so many artists aren't known outside that world. But you know what I'm saying? He's in some ways been pushed to the side.
Well, you push it aside. On the other hand, I would say that he's probably one of the artists that is most easily recognized in the black community. Part of that is because, again, because he had left politics, he wanted his art to be owned by and by, you know, black working class people. And so he published many of his pieces in a calendar that was put out by the black insurance company.
Right.
And so people could buy his prints for, you know, in a calendar form, or they could buy his prints in very inexpensive editions. So Masses and Mainstream, the left-wing Marxist journal of the 1940s and 1950s, they published a whole portfolio of his work, and I think it cost about $15. But he meant for that portfolio to be sold to ordinary people. So a lot of people in black community, working class people, knew his work.
I mean, and that also talked to the people you write about in Charles White living their political beliefs,
yes,
whether it was in their paintings or the work they wrote or how they lived their lives. Mm-hmm. They lived their political belief. It wasn't just something that they espoused in intellectual circles. And part of it because they came from this root of oppression. And through the Communist Party, they weren't, that became them, and they transformed that place as well.
And in a lot of ways, that is the reason that they are not as well known as other artists, because they always continue to do their political work.
Right. So, I mean, I was fascinated by the pieces on him and the whole the world they ran through and the people. I mean, you know, interesting when you talk about Charles White and the people that that were touched by him, that were in this circle, including Adam Clayton Powell and people you don't think about being in that world. The fact that you talk about in that time there were Ben Davis, who was a black man who was a communist and was a city councilman. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a huge thing going on at that moment. This was not some small thing, and the left, the Communist Party, was very powerful in parts of the black community here, Birmingham, Alabama, that you write about. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the history we don't talk about nor touch very much.
And one of the good things for artists at the time was that the left and the party created community for those artists. So, for example, Charles White comes up out of the Southside Community Arts Center in Chicago. Elizabeth Catlett runs through there at a certain point. Gwendolyn Brooks is coming through at a certain point. Margaret Burroughs. I mean, there is a community of artists working together because they're very serious about their art, working together on their art, but also working together for political change. And that is true of every one of the writers and artists in this book, that they always saw that as an integral part of their lives, the political activism. So on the one hand, it probably is the reason that they're not as well known, but then on the other hand, it's the reason that they could stay so connected to their work as well as the community.
I have to ask this question. What led you to this? What led you to – because and it's not something that most people just pick up and do. We joke before we start a conversation that there would be a lot of people who would – mm-hmm. this book may not be widely read by millions because of the subject. I mean, what led you to this subject? Made you spend all this time pouring through all this to bring it to light?
I think in some ways it's because I grew up in a conservative Catholic home. And that in some ways made me appreciate communism, because in a lot of ways Catholicism actually teaches you about social justice.
That's true.
But in another way, because I was such a child of the 1950s and so inundated with the kind of racial conservatism that came out of the 1950s, that I think I was hungry for this story. And it certainly just resonated with me.
Who led you to it? Who of the people you wrote about early led you to this story?
Well, I think it's probably mainly the scholars that are working in this period, like Alan Wall and Jim Smethurst and William Maxwell, Barbara Foley. Those people had already begun to do a lot of the excavation work for this, you know, for this. But also, you know, I grew up hearing words about people like Paul Robeson. You know, I grew up hearing about Langston Hughes. And in fact, I say in the introduction, if I had listened more carefully to some of the conversations among my uncles and aunts and mother and father, they talked about unions. In fact, one of the things I remember is that I was in grade school during the campaign, the presidential campaign with Eisenhower and Adlai Stevenson.
56 you're talking about?
It was
52 and 50s. I remember the campaign as well. Yeah, I was a kid.
Mid-1950s.
Right.
I'm in Catholic school, and everybody in school has an I Like Ike button on.
Right.
So I come home with my I Like Ike button, and I remember my uncle just looking at me and saying, "You better hope Stevenson wins." And I had no idea of what he meant, because everybody at school was, you know, on Eisenhower's side. But then later, when I started reading, I realized that Stevenson represented, for black people, he represented the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, and he represented someone who would stand up for unions. Now, whether he did all of that or not,
he was the
progressive candidate, and I did not know it. That's just how submerged any kind of racial or radical thought was being held at bay, was that you couldn't talk about Stevenson as a progressive.
Right.
But that's what he was considered. So I would say that I had little hints, you know, that there was another story out there that I needed to pursue. And then, you know, I was always interested in the 1950s again because I was marked by that period and marked by these conservative ideas that came out of Catholicism and came out of, you know, a working class family that promulgated the idea that you went to school, you kept your nose clean, you did all the right things, and you would be the subject that was ready for integration if you did all of those things. And I think that there was a kind of residual anger about that. That, you know, how could they do this to us? How could they take away, you know, this sense of a strong, powerful, muscular, racial philosophy? And so, you know, reading about writers who said, well, wait a minute, the Brown versus the Board of Education, that's not a progressive legal decision. Look at what Du Bois wrote in 1947, an appeal to the nation, or We Charge Genocide, another, you know, late 1940s, early 1950s document that said black people are like colonial subjects. They are being, you know, subjected to the worst kind of racial discrimination. And this is a discrimination that grows out of slavery, that this kind of discrimination needs to be understood as something that's part of the structure of the United States. Well, I never read that document.
Right.
You know.
Right.
So,
I'm sure not.
You know, I think when I came across these things, there was I think there was an ember already there. And it lit a fire.
There are things like the Committee for the Negro in the Arts.
Absolutely. This is, again, another one of the ways in which you see the left creating community. The Committee for the Negro in the Arts ran from probably about the late 1940s, probably 1948, somewhere around 1956 when communism became so discredited. Now, it's not a communist organization. It's an organization that considered itself progressive. There were communists in it. There were leftists in it. There were people who were just liberals in it. But it was mainly an organization that was begun in order to fight back against the cultural apartheid in the United States. Where are the black people in film, on the stage, in journals, all the ways in which the culture of African Americans was being marginalized, they were fighting against that. They were fighting for blacks to have roles in everything. This is an idea that was way before its time, because it takes maybe 15 more years before you begin to see something happening there. And these people are considered they're considered radical for saying this in 1952.
So before I ask you about a couple of the people in the book, like Alice Childress, which I think is really an important chapter, and and as you talk about finding the radical Alice Childress, when the House Un-American Activities Committee came into being, and Joe McCarthy went after everybody accusing him of being communist, we never talk about the effect that had on the black community or on these black artists and intellectuals as well.
Let's see, where can I begin? Coleman Young, for example, was called before HUAC and gave one of the most powerful testimonies against it, but then, of course, was blacklisted. Now, this is one of the people who's right at the heart of something like the National Negro Labor Council. People like Alpheus Hunton, who was working at the Council for African Affairs, blacklisted and jailed for a time. Every one of the major black political left organizations was decimated by HUAC and McCarthyism. And those were the very organizations, that those were like the citadel of real racial radicalism, real racial thought that was taking us in progressive directions. And it just kind of ended that. Well, I shouldn't say it did not end that, because many of these people morphed right over into the civil rights movement. And if you read the chapter on White, you see Charles White and Jack O'Dell and Ossie Davis. All of them said the next step was the civil rights movement. And I say after that, it was the black arts movement.
Right.
So there's another thing that gets lost, is this history and this continuity between the people who are on the left in the 1940s and 50s, and then what happens with, for example, Martin Luther King has two communists working for him. Jack O'Dell is one of them, and a stalwart supporter and fundraiser for the Southern Negro
Southern Christian Leadership Conference.
Right. Those people are working for him, and helping to fight with the in the Montgomery bus boycott. I mean, they're there right there all along. And in fact, I mean, if you look at any of those movements during the 1950s, the civil rights movement, you'll see that people are there on the fringes, but trying not to be known as former communists. But without that movement in the 40s and the 50s, which was radical, I don't think you would have had the same kind of troops ready for the 1950s.
Right.
And in fact, this is interesting. The last chapter in the book is on Julia Mayfield.
Yes, right.
And Mayfield has a novel, comes out in 1960, called The Grand Parade. And he has a scene at the end of that novel. He has a major character who is a former communist. He's left the Communist Party. And again, interesting, a different kind of leave-taking from the one that gets promoted as, with anti-communism. This man finds himself in a civil rights struggle, and he thinks to himself, where are the communists when we need them?
We have to take a very brief break, but don't go away. When we come back, we'll have the rest of my conversation with Dr. Mary Helen Washington about her book, The Other Blacklist, The African-American Literary and Cultural Left of the 1950s. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and we're talking with Dr. Mary Helen Washington. professor in the English department at the University of Maryland College Park. She's been a Bunting Fellow at Harvard University and taught at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. And I'm talking to her about her latest book, The Other Blacklist, The African-American Literary and Cultural Left of the 1950s. Part of that also says to me in the way some of these people moved, a number of the people moved out of the Communist Party.
Yes.
Was that we like to think that the people made a break and they hated it. But a lot of people left because they moved on for any number of artistic and political reasons, going, not condemning the communists or what they were, but saying, okay, I can't, just don't need to be in this authoritarian organization anymore.
Yes.
I just can't, this is not my bag. I can't do this. But nothing holding against them. And the fact that the civil rights movement, you look at what happened, and you mentioned it. I mean, that so much of the money raised in the beginning of the civil rights movement was either raised by communists and people on the left in the North or by the black church.
Yes.
That's the only way the movement survived.
Right.
Were those two bags of money.
Mm-hmm.
Bodies of funds, mm-hmm. I should say. Not bags of money, but bodies of funds. Well, in some cases, when Harry Belafonte tells a story about the bag of money he brought to Mississippi, mm-hmm. with Sidney Poitier, but I mean, mm-hmm. in literal sense. So I think that's – and also the way – that's one of the things I love about how you paint this is that mm-hmm. you are sensitive to that and kind of almost countering the argument that we like to use – like to use about this split, Richard Wright or some others who might have.
And that split has been told through the story of Richard Wright. I think more than any other literary figure, that's the figure that they turn to when they want to say this is the way blacks broke from the Communist Party and this is the one reason they broke from the party. And so he has an essay called I Tried to Be a Communist, which came out,
right.
I believe, in 1950.
The God That Failed.
In the book, The God That Failed.
Right.
CIA-sponsored book.
Right.
That's the essay that always is reproduced, always taught. This is, and then he becomes the symbol of the people who left the Communist Party. You could easily read Julian Mayfield's essay about why he left the Communist Party, because it's full of complexity, and he also does this in his novel, in The Grand Parade. He has a character who leaves, and he shows you all of the complex reasons that people moved away and how hard it was to leave that community and to leave those people who had ideals of social justice that you wanted to be connected to. So people left because they discovered the Khrushchev revelations. They left because, yes, it was authoritarian. Some people think Charles White left because he did not want to be under the thumb of white authority. Some left because, and I would say this is Jack O'Dell and most of them, they left because it was hard to be a communist under McCarthyism, and that the civil rights movement was a way to continue doing the work that you had done on the left,
right.
without being, you know, smashed by McCarthy.
Now, it's very uplifting, the book you wrote here. I mean, and gives you so great sense of these people.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk for a moment just about Alice Childress.
Oh,
let me talk
yes.
about a few.
I'd love to talk about her.
Talk a bit about that, because this is one of the lost people. I think, you know, whether it is the like one in the family or the play that she was really beaten up about.
A Wedding Band.
Wedding Band. Right. Yes.
And you know that's interesting because just mentioning those two things, a novel like One of the Family and her play, Wedding Band, she wrote in so many different kinds of forms and with so many different kinds of subjects. So Wedding Band is about an interracial relationship between a black woman and a white man, and it takes place during World War I. I think Childress also meant for it to have something to say about the 40s and 50s. But here's a play that no one has ever connected with the left. But throughout that play, the racial dynamics and the racial discussions and the racial tensions that she examines there, she's examining them with a very left point of view. In other words,
I never thought about this to your book.
I didn't think about it either until I wrote this book. But you know, she has the the white man continue to say, we should leave the prejudice outside. This is just between you and me. This is our love. What does it have to do with any kind of larger picture? That's kind of the racial liberalism view. And then she has the black woman say, no, this is about something larger than us. This is about something that you cannot just put, you can't say, leave the prejudice outside. It's everywhere. It's part of the structure of our lives. So, you know, I see that as one of the ways in which Childress is working on the left. I saw Trouble in Mind right here in Baltimore at Center Stage. And it's interesting because there were a lot of leftists in the audience, and they were the only people who got it, who got the fact that she was making comments about what it meant for a black artist, in this case an actor, to be on the left. And he says that he can't get an apartment and that, you know, that leftist, his leftist reputation follows him wherever he goes. And he is trying to keep his nose clean so that he can, you know, continue to work in on the stage. Not a lot of people saw that she was saying something about the blacklist and about that moment in the 1950s. And then if you go all the way back to 1951 to one of her first plays, which is called Gold to the Sun, that's a play in which she is showing the parallel between racism in the United States and apartheid in South Africa. Now, that just marks her as a woman of the left for a play in the
1950s. So how did she get lost in all that? You write about this in the book. How you and others resurrected, but how she got lost as a leftist?
We could just take the play Wedding Band, which she couldn't get it produced on Broadway. And in fact, she was working, trying to get it on Broadway with Joseph Papp, and he said, if you make the main character the white man, we could get it to Broadway.
Isn't that always the story?
And she absolutely refused to do that. So I would say that's one of the reasons that Alice Childress is not well known. And then I think, you know, she's certainly not well known as a leftist because people don't know Robeson's journal, Freedom. She worked on Freedom. And then also because when you read Like One of the Family, people have read Like One of the Family as a novel about a black woman domestic. They never read it as a novel about a black woman political activist, which is exactly what she is.
Right.
So I would say, you know, part of the reason she gets lost is because we don't know how to read her. But I think also because, again, this is someone who continued to work in community theater, continued to work on the left. And, you know, that was her goal. Was to be in the community.
And, you know, maybe think that what you just described now, and I thought about this as I was reading the book, but it really, as you said, it now really hit me that the movie The Help.
Yes.
This is like.
It's hard for me to comment on a movie like that.
No, but if they made a movie of that book,
yes,
it'd be like.
It would be the opposite of The Help.
Right, exactly.
Yes, yes.
The Help helping themselves.
Yes. As somebody said, you know, back in the 1960s, and she said, you know, that's when the civil rights movement was just heating up, and it was white women who were the help.
So that I love the Alice Childress. I used to love her plays as a really young person. I've really not gone back to them again, but you're sending me back here a lot. You're going to make me read stuff I haven't read in a long time. So, you are. So, let's talk a bit about Gwendolyn Brooks. Another
the one
person
who was the least well known as a leftist,
right.
And in fact, I just
that's why I love
something.
The name of your chapter.
When Gwendolyn Brooks wore red, and that was kind of trying to be provocative because she's almost certainly not in the Communist Party, but she was on the left. In fact, the first good review of her first book, which is Street in Bronzeville, that came out in 1945, the first review was by Alfred Kramberg, who was a communist, and it was in the Daily Worker. And she wrote a little note saying,
which was a communist paper.
Yes. Right. And she wrote a little note saying, I have had a very favorable review in the Daily Worker. And you can see that she's simply a part of the left at that point and not worried about being in the Daily Worker, in a communist journal. She also, you know, people, as I was saying, someone just a few days ago wrote something that said, Gwendolyn Brooks became a political activist in the late 1960s. And I think in the late 1940s, Brooks was out with her friend Margaret Burroughs, who was a communist, with these chains around their necks to protest against lynching, and wrote an anti-lynching poem, I think it was 1948 or 49. So, she can't be surrounded by all these left people and writing these left poems and not understand that she's a political activist. She's all the way through the mid-1950s. You know, she's in the South Side Community Arts Center, which was a real leftist, radical organization that helped to support artists that were on the left, including Charles White.
You write about the novel Maud Martha.
Yes.
That she wrote. And again, people don't know this novel very well, a lot of people. It's not highly read.
Published in 1953 and probably not read because the subject, the main character, is a working class black woman intellectual.
Right.
And I think it's hard for most people to even recognize that she's an intellectual. But this is someone who goes to the University of Chicago to hear the latest Negro author who's coming there. This is someone who's reading elegant novels. This is someone who's, you know, who understands words and is critiquing things like the ways in which universities use language that puts down the working class, that she understands that in a novel in 1953. Hardly anybody saw that.
So do you think from just out of what you're writing that she hid herself or was hidden from, hidden by?
I think both. I think she hid herself. I think she made a concerted effort to distance herself from the left.
For her own
career,
right.
For her own safety.
Right. Safety is an important part.
Exactly. So she has two autobiographies called Report from Part 1 and Report from Part 2, and she doesn't name anything that would connect her to the left. I mean, so that's a deliberate kind of omission, and I understand it. I understand she wanted a career, and she wanted a career in the mainstream.
And to be black in America and on the left and trying to create a career in the mainstream was a contradiction. It was almost impossible to do.
Yes. And she pretty much did it. I mean, she won the Pulitzer Prize
right.
in 1950, first African-American woman to win that prize, even though many times people will say that it was Alice Walker in 1987. But she was the second.
Right. Mm-hmm. Long time in between.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Long time in between. So there's a few other people in here that I think that would be kind of really interesting for our listeners to get a sense of.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the Browns. Well, Frank London Brown, for one.
Ah, yes. Well, Lloyd Brown is the first chapter in the
yes,
book.
Yes, the very first chapter. That's
right.
Why I said
and,
for one.
And
no, two
he's
Browns.
The first chapter because the book has a kind of chronological narrative. It starts in 51 with Lloyd Brown and his novel Iron City, and it ends in 1960 with Julian Mayfield's The Grand Parade and with the other Brown, Frank London Brown, whose novel Trumbull Park comes out in 1959. So I wanted that whole arc of the decade of the 1950s to be covered. And I wanted to start with Lloyd Brown because he is the only open communist in the other blacklist, in my book. He was always a dedicated communist. I think he left the Communist Party somewhere around 56 or 57, but he was openly a communist. So open that when the FBI accosted him in New York City, he always lived in New York City, and he worked for the New York Times in the printing division. And he said the FBI would follow him around from time to time, and they would go in and talk to his employer. And he would just tell them, you know, there's just no point in you asking me anything because I'm dedicated to the Communist Party and that's where I am. And when I found his FBI file, I was so relieved that the whole FBI file confirms that he was just a dedicated, honest communist organizer, you know, starting back in Ohio and in other places in the Midwest. He did union organizing. But in 51, he published a novel, Iron City, and he published also two essays called Which Way for the Negro Artist or Negro Writer. And none of that was known. When I began to write about Lloyd Brown, he was just like a figure that had never existed. It was almost like he was just non-existent.
Right.
Alan Wall did the first introduction to Iron City, and I did, I think, the first full-length article on him. But here's a novel that is just so fabulous. But because it has a sympathetic attitude toward the communist organizers who are several of the characters in the book, you know, it had to be discredited. But it's a wonderful novel for, again, focusing on a working class character who has such power and such dynamism. And you think, okay, here's the black proletariat. Why is it that Native Son has this position of the most important black working class figure in African American literature? No, it should be these characters from Iron City who are not done in like Bigger Thomas, but who are, you know, working class and powerful and activists. You know, they help to get another young man out of jail. So it has all of the same themes as Native Son, but with a completely different attitude toward the black characters. The black characters have potency and agency.
That's the power of my. I have the pamphlet, Which Way the Negro Artist, that I've had since I was like 15. And so I knew that, but I had not read his novel. Mm-hmm. Now I'm going to have to unearth this one now and
yes,
and find this.
Very important.
And I think this is extremely important stuff. I think you're unveiling. Mm-hmm.
And then Frank London Brown, who's the other Brown,
right,
at the end of the blacklist, is a man who got radicalized in the Union, and he's working for the Meatpackers Union, and which was a union that always had communists in it. I don't know that Brown was a communist, but he's working for this union, which had at its core fighting for jobs for black women. Again, you know, a completely radical idea in the 1950s. But, you know, here's a union that's saying, you know, these are the people who would have been the most left out of the, you know, our workers who have the least power and, you know, the worst jobs. These are the people we should be promoting through the Meatpackers Union.
And those stories, also you have other stories to hear about unions and the unions that were mm-hmm. filled with revolutionary black people who were part of those unions mm-hmm. and making the fight. And there's a story about whose name I'm blocking on, going back to Birmingham, Alabama to organize, and organize early and kind of stood up in the and I think the line was she used, I'm not getting orders from Moscow. I'm fighting for the...
That's Esther Jackson.
Esther Jackson. Right. The Jackson family. The two Jacksons,
yeah.
Right.
Esther
went back to Birmingham, Alabama.
And James Jackson
right.
were working in Alabama with the Southern Negro Youth Congress, which is kind of a forerunner to SNCC. And they are working all during the 40s in Alabama. They got run out of Alabama, really, by Bull Connor. But they were working in Alabama with black kids, with black institutions, and really just fighting discrimination. And she said, you know, we were fighting against discrimination. We were not taking orders from Moscow.
That was a great line.
Right. Yeah.
And I thought that you put in the book, and I think that in some ways these are the kind of heroes and heroines, the people that we have forgotten, we can't forget, because when you think about people like them, mm-hmm. who on the left, black, in the South, standing up to the racial terrorism that existed in that period. I mean, you know, it's Martin Luther King may have led the movement along with SNCC and CORE and the others that broke the back mm-hmm. of racial terrorism in the South. But these people before them, standing up to it.
They paved the way.
They paved the way.
And they did it at a time, I mean, it was dangerous during King's time too, because we know that you know, J. Edgar Hoover came down completely on him. But they were doing this at a time when there was no media coverage of what was happening to them.
Right. Nobody cared.
No.
Other than people on the left. Right. And they tried to put – and sometimes the Negro – the Negro is the black press of the day. I mean, they would publish these stories, but that would be
– Yeah, the black press was heroic.
Right.
Black press covered all of that. And, in fact, there are some people right now working on the way in which the black press covered the left, because that's where you can find many of the articles about what was happening to the left and in the Communist Party. They weren't afraid to publish that for a long time, up until about the mid-50s. And then they backed away, too,
right.
Because that's one of the things I say about Frank London Brown is that the novel Trumbull Park, you know, shows him still in his very radical period. But shortly after that, we begin to see him muting that kind of radicalism and even publishing something in the Chicago Defender that I would say was pretty anti-communist.
The more you see life, the more you see why, for complex reasons, it's easy for people, even the strongest people, to get backed into a corner.
Yes.
Because just the power that comes at them and their own trying to survive in this the madness.
But there's
the world.
An interesting scene in his novel, Trumbull Park, where he talks about having a sign and protesting in front of one of the downtown Chicago buildings where one of the HUAC hearings was being held. And he's down there with his sign and with other people around, and it's a sign that says, you know, why are you doing this to people who are political activists but not doing anything about black terrorism against blacks
black
in
people.
The South.
Yep.
And then, again, about 5 years later, there's a picture of Frank London Brown standing in front of a downtown department building, a kind of similar scene, and he has a briefcase in his hand. And it's almost as if to say, well, times have changed. Now I'm trying to get in this building instead of protesting against what's going on in the building.
Mm-hmm. All kinds of complexities to life.
Yes.
So you ended with Julian Mayfield.
Yes. I ended with Julian Mayfield, again, because I thought that he made a perfect ending because he went into the Communist Party in the mid-50s when it was really on the wane.
People, because most people came in the 30s, 40s, and 50s and
That's
maybe
right.
ran away in the
and
50s.
And they ran away in the 50s, and he goes into the 50s.
Right.
And I think it was about 55, 54. And people ask him, well, why did you do that? And he said, because this was the most powerful organization that I could join that was fighting against racial discrimination. There wasn't anything more powerful than the Communist Party. So I went into it then. And he's also the one who left and who says, at least through his novel, that he left because there were just so many kinds of tensions there, and he wanted to move into the civil rights movement. So he kind of makes the perfect ending for this book.
It does.
You know, so it's not a downer. It's not,
right.
you know, how did we fail, but how do we transition?
No, and I thought throughout the whole book, you're also very honest about the tensions, black and white, inside the Communist Party, that those existed and why they existed, and the kind of the deep contradictions that were in there as well, and but also the beautiful world of black and white together that was created in this revolutionary communist movement, and also a world the way you paint it as a world that where there was room and there was also room for the development of black consciousness, not just a white dominated black consciousness, but a black consciousness.
A perfect way to describe the interracialism of the left. That there was room for this kind of black consciousness, there was support for this kind of black consciousness, and there was a way in which they used the words that were necessary. They didn't say prejudice, they said white supremacy. So that was a kind of interracialism that you could be proud to be part of.
Right. Well, this is an amazing book. I'm so happy you wrote it. Someone had to do this. I'm glad you did it.
Thank you.
The Other Blacklist, Mary Helen Washington, the African-American Literary and Cultural Left of the 1950s. It's a really a very important book and one of the – it's an exciting book and really well written and is as engaging as I think this conversation was. And thank you so much.
Thank you.
We have to take a very brief break, but don't go away. When we come back, I'll talk with Miriam Powell about her new book about Cesar Chavez. It's bigger.